It's Behind the Headlines on WLIW-FM. This is our weekly chance to sit down with award-winning journalists who cover the East End and talk about the week's news. That was Penny, probably, right? Bill, is that who that was?
That's Penny. Yes, she's very excited because she chased either a squirrel or a cat this morning up a tree, and so she's anxious to go in and out today and go see if it's back.
And to
near,
tell you
near
about
the big
it.
Tree. So we're a little uptight.
Penny will be our special guest today, off and on. I'm Joe Shaw. I'm the executive editor of the Express News Group. We publish the Southampton Press, the East Hampton Press, the Sag Harbor Express, the website 27east.com, and Express Magazine. With us, with Penny, is Bill Sutton, who is our managing editor of the Express News Group. Good morning, Bill. Good morning, Penny. In the background, and Cole.
Yeah, don't forget Cole, who'll get jealous. Good morning, yes. Joe. Good morning, everybody.
This is the joy of recording a podcast from home. Great panel with us, probably with various types of pets in the background. We have Joe Workmeister, who's a staff writer at Newsday. Hey, Joe.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. We have Denise Civiletti, who's the editor of Riverhead Local. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning, accompanied by Cleo and Bella.
There you go. We have a big group today. And we have Brian Cosgrove, who is the host of the Afternoon Ramble right here at WLIW-FM. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So, thought we'd start with something that's not exactly a local story, but is a local story, and that is the eclipse that's going to be happening on Monday, which a lot of folks are talking about. So we had a big explainer, Bill, about the eclipse, and we'll just start with an underlined comment, which is please, please, please do not look directly into the sun at any point to view the eclipse. There are safe ways
unless you're running for president, and then feel free.
Yes, exactly. He has done that.
Yes. I was gonna say it.
It's not a good idea, even for a second or two. And so so let's talk the eclipse. Well, there's going to be a total eclipse, and there will be a swath of the country that will get to see it. But we don't, right, Bill?
No, we're going to see about 90% coverage, I guess, here on Long Island. I'm jealous. You know, all my friends in Rochester and Syracuse, they're going to see 100% eclipse, I guess. I don't know how much of a difference there is between 100% and 90%, I guess.
10%.
Yeah, thank you.
That's
journalism.
Well, it's gonna start at about here. We're gonna start noticing it around 2:13 PM exactly on Monday, with maximum coverage around 3:27 PM. And it's expected to end around 4:37 PM. So that's you know, a good couple hours there where we're going to notice the anomaly. I remember the last one. It's a really odd feeling because it's the middle of the day, and you know, and the skies start to feel a little gray and a little dark. And I think all those primal fears kind of come back, that you know, that the sun is going away or whatever. But yeah, so we had a story talking about it this week, that you know, again, be very careful when looking at it. You can buy special glasses, but they have to be rated to be able to look at them. So don't use your sunglasses, get the special glasses. Or you can, I think we had a QR code in the paper that gives you directions on how to build a pin projector, or I forget if that's the exact name for it, or whatever.
Pinhole projector, I think.
Pinhole projector, where you can kind of be able to look at the reflection of the eclipse as the moon travels in front of the sun.
Anybody Why is here? It dangerous to look into the to look at it? Can you explain that briefly? Sorry.
I believe it's because the sun's the power of the sun isn't reduced all that much even during an eclipse, that it's enough to damage your eyes even if you briefly look into the sun. So it's really important that the the glasses, the eclipse glasses that they sell, look basically opaque. Like you can't see anything through them. So, and it's because then when you look up, you can just see the outline of the sun. But it's right. a very dangerous thing. And people do, people do get their eyes damaged just by briefly looking. And I was surprised to discover that in the folks that who get to see the total eclipse, at the moment that there's a total eclipse, you can actually take your glasses off and view it briefly. But I was surprised at that because I wouldn't think, I had always thought that it was just as dangerous. Learning some things.
Yeah, I guess as it's happening, it's almost, you almost physically can kind of look at it and you know, it, your eyes don't tempting. Just want to like divert. You're right. It's sort of tempting, but as you said, the damage can be happening even though you don't realize it at the moment. I'm trying to remember, since in 2017, was it kind of a little cloudy that day? I sort of remember it not being like as...
Wasn't that dramatic, right?
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, this is the next one's not for about 20 years. So I guess, and the weather looks pretty decent for Monday. So I think we might be okay for not too much cloud coverage.
Yeah, and I think you touched on it, that whole idea of a primal thing where you look up and it's, and I, one of the great little pieces of trivia that I love about this is the only reason this works is because the sun is 400 times bigger than the moon, but the moon is 400 times closer than the sun. So that coincidence makes this possible. They're basically exactly the same size in the sky. And I think that's one of those little amazing math things that makes it possible. It's the kind of stuff that really I really enjoy. Anybody have any viewing parties? I know our good friend Annette Hinkle, who's on our staff, is traveling to Ohio back to her where she grew up to see it. None of you guys are making the trip, huh? We're all stuck here looking at 90%.
Yeah. My wife has a lot of friends up near Rochester and, you know, upstate New York in that area. But, you know, we're not making a trip out of it, unfortunately. Probably would have been a smart idea to, you know, plan something to go visit then around now, since we wouldn't have had to worry about, paying $400 for a Super 8 motel or anything like that.
I saw that article in the Times that Super 8 motels are normally $95 a night and they're almost $1,000 a night in the swaths of that. I think that's, God bless America.
That's their only opportunity to ever capitalize on.
Talk about your high-end stays, huh?
Well, that's also why you can't look right at the Saint Denis, because there's a big market for the special glasses leading up to the
eclipse. Yes.
Locally, Joe, the Longhouse Reserve and the East Hampton Library will be having viewing parties. I imagine probably there's a couple other institutions that we didn't hear about either. But if you want to be in a crowd, you can certainly go to that. Longhouse Reserve is 1:30 to 4:30, and East Hampton Town Library starts at 2 p.m. to view the eclipse, and I'm sure they'll have the glasses and, you know, and viewers and that type of thing.
Yeah, in Southold, the Custer Institute, pretty cool facility up there. They have an event, and they can hold about 200 people, and it does the recommended advanced registration. So, by the time people hear this, and maybe filled up, but there's still some spots there. That's a cool spot to potentially check out the eclipse.
Me.
Please, we beg you, don't look directly into the sun to view the eclipse. I just want to make sure we get that message across to people. There are ways to do it safely, and you should definitely find one of them for sure. Yeah, okay. I feel like everybody's talking about this. It's got a lot of folks excited. I really wish we were in the path of totality, I believe they call it. Which would be a lot of fun, because from what I hear, when you really witness a total eclipse, it's very striking that it's not something people forget.
I saw something listed. I don't at present, right at this moment, I don't have a pet, but I saw that if you leave your pets at home and you're not going to be there during the eclipse, to close all the blinds.
Really?
Yeah, to make sure you close all the blinds and everything. I guess maybe there's the possibility a pet could do this, look up, you know, jump on the window and look up or something. But it's not a bad idea. I mean, it wouldn't hurt, right?
So we need to equip all of our dogs and cats with glasses.
Or close the blind.
Well, you don't want them to miss it either, though. I mean, you know.
Well, I wonder if that primal thing, if they just kind of freak out a little bit and they're not sure what's going on.
I was going to say, like, the sky suddenly going dark. I think Bella, who's like a nervous little dog, would probably, and in tune to all kinds of interesting things, I think she would notice that and start panting and shaking like she does during wind and rainstorms. Never mind thunder.
What does Penny have to say about this?
She's really very excited. She's wondering if it would be a good opportunity to chase a squirrel.
She's working on her pinhole camera right now, her pinhole projector, so she could see it. No question. So that's what's the times again on Monday, Bill, so that we know?
Oh, I just
I think it's 3 to 3:30.
It starts around 2:13.
Okay.
And maximum coverage is around 3:27. I'm not sure how we got that exact with it. And it's expected to end around 4:37.
Oh, wow.
Did you see the Yankees?
So 3:30 is going to be peak.
Yeah. I was going to say, did you see the Yankees originally scheduled a game at the exact time of the eclipse as like a cool event, like a game during the eclipse? And then everyone was like, that's probably not a good idea. And then they had to push it back yesterday to 6 o'clock.
Why is that not a good idea?
Maybe catching fly balls looking at the sky during an eclipse.
Not fly.
goes dark.
I got it. Light again.
Everybody has to wear the eclipse glasses.
They could have done free glass night, like the free bat night that they used to have.
It seems like the kind of thing the Mets would have tried to do.
I was just going to say that, Joe.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be a cool thing to experience. And as you said, Bill, I think it's going to be, or Joe, I think you mentioned it's going to be like 20 years or 30 years. And I think it may be even longer till there's a total eclipse.
Yeah, I think like 40 years.
Yeah, I think I may not see the next total eclipse, so I want to make sure we get out.
I'm gonna try to locate my old. I took a Polaroid photo with my old Polaroid. I can't remember what those are. Right, you peel off the top and of the solar eclipse in 1970.
Nice.
I still have that somewhere. It was a very unimpressive photo, it's still around here someplace. I've got it.
I do. So
why throw anything away?
I remember.
So Joe Werkmeister was right. The next eclipse in the United States will be in August of 2044, but it won't be until 2079 that it returns to New York again.
I'm having a watch party that day.
Good luck.
Will this program still be going at that
point? That's our goal, Joe.
This episode might still be going.
We'll have an AI. There'll be an AI panel doing it by then, but it'll be a similar experience. So let's move on. Let's talk about some local issues. There was an RV park up around Riverhead, Denise. That talk about what happened this week. Something significantly happened with that, right?
Well, I can't say I'm totally sure exactly what it was, but guy and his attorney came to the town board to pitch this RV park at the EPCAL site a couple weeks prior. And the town board seemed fairly enthusiastic about it. It included a 100-acre man-made lake. That was going to be a call for the extraction of a whole bunch of sand, which the developer of this RV park was going to sell and profit from. And the town board, like I said, they seemed like they were in support of it. They said things that were very supportive. And
this was in the Enterprise Park, right?
Yeah, in the Enterprise Park, actually off just off of the 10,000 foot active runway, in the precise area that 555's Calverton Aviation and Technology Group there had designated as their phase one development. I don't know if that had anything to do with anything, but that's where this was proposed. And the couple weeks later, the town board said, nah, ain't happening. We don't want that. And Supervisor Hubbard was talking about, you know, the value of the asset, you know, the materials that would be shipped, you know, dug up and shipped off site to the profit of a private developer, and you know, just sort of kind of pulled the plug and the lake dried up.
That was kind of a weird part of the proposal. I remember you talking about it a couple of weeks ago that, you know, that they would come in and rent the land, right? And then then sell the sand off of it to create this lake. It's not like they were even buying the property.
Right. And I got to say, I was kind of like, what? Really? That? But I don't know. I didn't have anything to do with them changing their mind, but I don't think that was necessarily a bad decision.
Was the idea here that it would be like a recreational RV park rather than the housing, right? It would have been more
camp park, campsite. I don't know, for RVs, at which, you know, the supervisor said he declared he's an RVer, and you know, he first session go around and he had a very hard time. If you don't like immediately get a site on January 1st, you can't get one anywhere in Suffolk County. It's crazy. There's no RV sites, so he was happy about it. But you know, I guess they all realized that, you know, this might not be the best deal for town taxpayers.
Yeah, seems like, and the idea of excavating the lake and selling the sand, that's a smart idea for the person proposing it. But if you don't own the land.
Well,
they didn't announce that they weren't doing this. Oh, I'm sorry, Bill.
No, it's all right. I was just going to say.
They didn't announce they were doing this. Like a resident got up and said, I understand that the RV park is dead in the water, and they acknowledged it. And I was sitting there like, what? I don't know. What, you know, anyway.
And we all know
how he got that information. Mining, I'm not sure still.
So. Once they start mining land on Long Island, you just can't get them to stop. So the lake would have just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a very profitable thing to do. Sand is, as Supervisor Hubbard said, like gold. He said that at the first meeting. And to some extent, that's true. It's maybe not quite that valuable, but, you know, and the state has a very strong pro mining policy. They want to see sand mines. And you know, that's been to what a lot of local people consider the great detriment of the local environment and landscape here. So we've certainly had our share of sand mines, legal and illegal, here in Riverhead, as you guys have, you know, on the South Fork as well. So. But we're still in court. The town of Riverhead's still in court with a sand mine that, you know, isn't pre-existing mine that the DEC was looking to, up until the Sandland decision that you're all familiar with. They were looking to allow this mine to expand vertically and mine right into the groundwater, right next to the old town dump.
Mm-hmm.
Which presented a host of environmental problems, and the town objected, and so the town sued the DEC, and then the sand mine company sued the DEC and the town, and the DEC kind of withdrew what they said they were going to do and its intention to permit it. But now the sand mine company is suing the town and the DEC over this because they want to get that permit. So
take a step back and look too at that EPCAL site. And, you know, I'm just fascinated by, you know, I think a lot of municipalities think it would be kind of cool to fall into a blank slate like that, where you have EPCAL and you have the ability to do all kinds of things there. But how many years has it been and the town is still struggling with how to use that property in some manner? It's been more of a burden, it seems, than an opportunity.
It certainly has, I believe, because for a number of reasons, not the least of which is some of the environmental issues that exist on that site. I mean, you know, there's groundwater pollution, there's soil pollution. It's still in remediation. Parts of it are still being remediated by the Navy. And now with the awareness, the new awareness of these forever chemicals polluting soils and waters like PFAS and PFOA, right, and 1,4 dioxin, there's like a whole new remediation going on to address those issues. The Navy has just flat out refused to acknowledge any responsibility because the Navy owned this property. It was a gigantic property that was much of it was leased to the Grumman Corporation for decades. There's been, just like at the other facility that Grumman operated in Bethpage, there are groundwater plumes that are migrating offsite, carrying pollutants to people's, you know, groundwater and their private drinking water wells south of the site. And, you know, remedying that is a very expensive endeavor when you're talking about extending public water mains to a relatively few number of users at, you know, the far end, like one corner of the town, and it's very costly. The town and the Suffolk Water Authority, Suffolk County Water Authority, which serves some of those homes, have gotten, you know, state and federal grant monies and stuff to help underwrite the cost of that. But the Navy has just said, not our problem, and not, you know, has, you know, not responded in any way to pressure from Senator Chuck Schumer, Kirsten Gillibrand, former Congressman Lee Zeldin, Congressman Nick LaLota have all, you know, lobbied and, you know, the Navy to do something, step in here. But, you know, they've got so many locations in similar conditions across the country that they're loath to set a precedent by stepping in and saying, oh, yeah, we'll help clean this mess up that our contractor, you know, made over the decades. So it's a very gnarly problem. But overall, I mean, that's the environmental issues. But, you know, overall, what do you do with a site like that? I mean, the reason Grumman left and the industry that it, you know, participated in left Long Island for the most part was that it was no longer a satisfactory place to do, you know, jet fighter tests and things like that. I mean, you know, it was originally when it was sited there, it was a very remote area. There were very few people living there. And then it got developed. And so, you know, now it's surrounded by homes and the people that live in those homes are, you know, rightfully kind of frightened for the most part, most of them, by the prospect of any kind of airport use there. That's something that's come up a number of times over the years. But when you've got like a big piece of industrial land like this, you would be amazed by the people that sort of come out of the woodwork with sometimes cockamamie proposals for what to do with it because they want, you know, and the town, you know, seems to have never gotten over its penchant for looking kindly on some of these things. I don't know. So it's just, this has been going, the town got the property from the federal government in the 1990s. And this has been going on like this ever since. And I used to joke many years ago that I would still be writing about this till, you know, the day I died and it would not be resolved. And now it doesn't seem like a joke anymore. It's not going to be resolved anytime soon.
Hey, Denise, did I see recently that Riverhead Town got a grant to help with water purification?
Yeah, Riverhead's gotten a number of grants to, well, mostly to bring water to public water to homes, as opposed to like installing purification systems. The DEC will install, if you're like, you know, right up the road from where I live, actually, there's homes that are affected by PFAS and the DEC will supply bottled water and will install systems in their houses, in their basements to do water purification there. And that's like the expensive way. I think that's probably more expensive than even running public water. But, you know, basically the town has been very aggressive in seeking funding for, you know, public water extensions. And, you know, there's so There's so much water pollution. I mean, that's really the biggest problem. And, you know, and now again, these, you know, emerging contaminants are presenting a whole host of new issues and problems to be solved, and they're expensive problems to solve. So, but they're important to address because these pollutants are, you know, have very serious potential health consequences. So,
yeah. What West Hampton just got, I think it was over $1 million, close to $1.5 million, for the same thing, to hook people up to public water. I think it was, you know, around 50 homes. Don't quote me on that, but it was because of the PFAS, because of the, you know, these forever chemical pollutants. It's a huge deal.
And they were used at the airport, I think, right? That was the
right at Kabrowski.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one of the main sources of that is a firefighting foam, and that's why kind of like places like this, there's significant pollution with that, because, you know, they did training exercises to train firefighters on how to fight a fire when it involves jet fuel burning. and then there were accidents and crashes on the site and around the site that they actually had to use it to. Or they did use that stuff to put the fires out. So there's a significant amount of pollution all around. And then, of course, with like some of these chemicals, they're in everything. I mean, we got a press release last week about how popular lawn fertilizers that are like slow release lawn fertilizers that even they sound like they're eco-friendly lawn fertilizers, but they, because of like a plastic coating that they use to make them, you know, slow release, that puts PFAS in our groundwater when, you know, when the rain, you know, rains, trickles it down into the groundwater. I mean, you know, all PFAS chemicals in shampoos and detergents. Mm-hmm. And things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, they're finding, the more they look, the more they find. And, you know, it's
kind of scary too that they use the term forever chemicals when they talk about PFAS. Yeah. It just sort of drives home the danger there, no question. So. This is Behind the Headlines on WLIWFM. I'm Joe Shaw. My co-host is Bill Sutton. We're with the Express News Group. Our panelists this week are Joe Werkmeister of Newsday, Brian Cosgrove of right here at WLIWFM, and Denise Civiletti of Riverhead Local. Joe, we were talking about the airport there. The airports, I know in East Hampton also has had some, they had some firefighting drills in that region, and that caused some PFAS damage. But let's talk about the airport. There was some news this week about East Hampton Town Airport, which is its new name. It has a new name, but doesn't look like the town's going to get to do its maneuver that would have allowed it to take over more control over what could fly into the airport and when. Can you explain a little bit about what happened?
Yeah. So, you know, there's been this long ongoing effort on the town's part to try to limit, you know, aircraft going in and out to the airport, as people have complained about the constant noise and potential environmental impacts. So this has been ongoing for, you know, quite a long time. And, you know, every effort by the town seems to be, you know, held up by litigation, and the courts seem to be ruling against the town. And this latest ruling by the appellate division essentially upheld an earlier state Supreme Court ruling that said the town could not just close its public airport and reopen it as a private airport as a way to gain more control over the operations and then set more restrictions on, you know, aircraft times and things like that. And so it's another setback for the town. You know, they had tried this in 2022, and, you know, quickly there was a number of lawsuits filed from, you know, different aviation interests and people out in Montauk who were nervous that by, you know, restricting aircraft into East Hampton, it's just going to divert more traffic out into the small airport in Montauk. And, you know, there's a lot of concerns from people out there of what that would look like, and, you know, whether they could handle that. You know, do they have the proper firefighting capabilities if there was going to be an accident, and things like that. So So, you know, the town, again, saying they're disappointed in this latest ruling. And the latest now is that they are going to try to appeal. And the last resort here is to take it to the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York. And the Court of Appeals is not automatically going to take this and look at it. You know, they would have to first decide whether there's merits, I suppose you could say, to examine, you know, whether there was an issue. So the Court of Appeals could decide that there's not a reason to look at it. And then, you know, that would essentially, I guess, be it. So what the appellate court essentially ruled was that the town comply with these federal requirements to do what they were trying to do. And it goes back to what's called the, just look at it up here, the Airport Noise and Capacity Act of 1990, as we're all, I'm sure, very familiar with. But essentially what that act did was set kind of a federal guideline for airport operators if they want to set noise restrictions and different things at a, you know, at an airport. And to do so, it's a really long, expensive process from what I understand. And I think the town actually had tried doing this a couple of years back when, in this whole process, and eventually abandoned that plan. So as it would stand now, they would have to complete this, what's called a Part 161 study. And I guess that would go hand in hand with what the town is already trying to do with this long state environmental review. That's already about a year or so in. And so, as of right now, it's a win for the people who want to keep the airport open, and a loss for the people who want to see less traffic at the airport.
Just to be clear, Joe, we should explain to people that what the town did was essentially say, well, under the current conditions, they aren't permitted to do much as far as controlling the type of traffic that comes in and out of the airport. When you're a public airport, the FAA rules apply, and you don't really have any local ability to say, we're not going to allow loud aircraft. We're going to limit the number of flights in by helicopters, which are some of the things that the town wanted to do. So the town came up with this novel idea of essentially on paper just closing the airport for one day and then reopening it as a new facility. And they kind of say they had the tacit approval of federal authorities to do that.
They did. They worked with the FAA for over a year to put that in place. And, you know, the important part of that puzzle too is that, FAA grant money or grants had expired at the airport. So that, you know, as long as that was in place, then the town kind of had a lack of control of the airport. But the town's argument was once those grant assurances were gone from the airport, then they could control, you know, the airport and go forward with this process. But now the court's saying no.
Yeah, it's been a lengthy debate, right, Joe? I mean, and the town has been to court many times on this issue, trying to get some control over the airspace coming into the flights coming into the airport, but they haven't really been very successful.
Yeah, I mean, and this is not just the local town attorney kind of trying to figure this all out. You know, they've had this outside counsel working on this, and it's been a lot of money spent into this. And, you know, that's one of the things we keep hearing about from, the people who are in this lawsuit is, look how much money, the town keeps spending, they keep losing, and they want to see the town kind of come to the table and sort of maybe see if they can come to an agreement and some kind of, restrictions that maybe would make sense for everyone. And maybe there's a compromise somewhere that they could come to that would, benefit everyone. I don't know if that's a possibility or not, but.
Well, I mean, the pilots and the helicopter companies and the air companies have kind of, whether it's, disingenuous or not, have all come forward and said that they're willing to negotiate and to try to come up with some compromises with the town and try to, work out a plan that, that doesn't put them out of business, but, kind of lessens some of the noise for neighbors and stuff too. I think maybe that's the way to go forward, is just to try to bring these groups together better. I mean, there's been this fighting though for years between these two camps and these two sides. So I don't know how possible that is, but seems like that would be the better solution at this point.
I think there's an irony, Joe, that the town, I think, went directly to the federal government and seemed to work out a possible solution to all this, only to have the courts step in and say, nope, sorry, doesn't work that way. And the next question now is whether the town is going to undertake that lengthy process to go through the federal process to truly do what they wanted to do, which is close the airport as one facility and then reopen it as a non-public airport where they could control things a little more closely.
Yeah, and the town board met Wednesday. They scheduled a special meeting to go into executive session with attorneys to kind of talk through next steps, and haven't really heard anything too specific about what that might be, aside from just
they did say they want to appeal, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that court filing had been in as of I think April 1st. So a few days that had been in before they met on Wednesday. So that if anything really new came out of that discussion, I'm not 100% sure. Town's been pretty tight-lipped, it seems, about this. Sending out some statements here and there, and it's been hard to even get any of the attorneys to talk about it. So.
Had to be quite a blow, I think, for town officials, I would think, because a couple of years ago they were all very, very positive and optimistic about this plan, and that that they were going to be able to do this temporary closure and address all these noise complaints that just keep coming in and in.
Do you guys remember? I'm thinking about something. I want to say a couple of years ago. I'm not that great with time. That there was, and I don't know if this is not connected to the East Hampton per se, but there was going to be like a floating dock off of Sag Harbor, and seaplanes were going to pull up and then dump people on this floating dock. And then there was going to be like a little ferry to take them in. Do you remember that?
Yes. I think they were talking about helicopters landing.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
And seaplanes.
Floating helipad, right? Yeah.
Yeah, this has always been one of the threats that's been out there against the town, to suggest that if they do some of the stricter things, that the companies that are ferrying people out in the summertime in particular by air will find ways around it. And that's always been one of the big concerns. And starting to land on water, I think in Sag Harbor, there would be some challenges to that because there's different waters out there. And I think the idea was they could land farther out in the bay, in Peconic Bay. And then, as you said, you bring people in by boat. And there was also, one of the big concerns in the background here is that it's going to cause a bump in traffic at Montauk Airport and at Gabreski to some degree. And also, at the helipad in Southampton Village, which a lot of people forget is there. So
Where is there a helipad in Southampton Village?
There's a helipad down along the water, in the estate section. There's one down there.
That makes sense.
I thought it was on the roof of the 27 East headquarters.
yeah, we bring.
Don't tell anybody about that, Joe.
Yeah,
that's a secret. That's how Joe gets back and forth to his golf trips.
Yes, exactly. That's the private helicopter was a perk I negotiated in my last contract. This is Behind the Headlines on WLIWFM. I'm Joe Shaw. Bill Sutton is my co-host, and our panelists are Denise Civiletti of Riverhead Local, Brian Cosgrove of WLIW, and Joe Workmeister of Newsday. Let's switch gears. And Brian, I want to talk about something that's happening right outside your office at WLIW on Hill Street in Southampton Village. They installed some new features out there, right? It's essentially traffic islands, pedestrian islands, but also they're meant to sort of control the flow of traffic right through that little section of Hill Street. I'm hearing mixed reviews about them.
Yeah. Well, we're, you know, I guess they know better than I do, I guess. But it's right at, essentially, it's at the end of the business district of Hill Street. And when you start to get into the residential stretch, as you start to head, let's say you're heading west and you, and we're like one of the last businesses on the right-hand side. And they put those in, but, you know, I mean, there's no parking now in front of, essentially, they for some reason, we can't park in front of the radio station. And like, I don't know if it's all the way down to Paul's. Maybe it's a little bit further west than that, maybe by the boxing or by the movie theater. But you can, we can't park at all. And they're putting in these two islands, which, like you said, are kind of, it's going to look nice. I guess they're going to put, you know, flowers and stuff in there. But I'm just...
I think the idea is to sort of create left turning lanes, right?
Yes, and, it is. It's good. Right. Exactly. So I don't, and you know, a lot of people who peel off to make that left and then try to go around the Hill Street stuff and come out on Lee, it's going to be much harder to do that because of those two islands that they're putting in there. So it's an interesting thing. It's going to be, to navigate.
We'll see more this summer as the traffic, you know, as the traffic picks up a little bit. I think Joe was right. I mean, the idea is that, you know, to create the two lanes so that as cars are stopped waiting to make the left turn onto First Neck, that, you know, that you have that other right lane that's going to, the traffic will continuously flow. I think, you know, as it was before, I mean, everybody just stopped, you know, or it was just a big mess as those cars were getting ready to make that left turn.
I think there's going to be a learning curve.
Yeah.
For a lot of drivers, you know, and
well, you're right there, Brian. You can get out there and kind of help direct traffic a little bit.
Yeah, I feel I could, but I'm not gonna. So thanks. Yeah, but you know, between everybody looking down at their phone and you know, it's and people who you know, unfortunately, is a whole big you know that have to come from Up Island to work out here. You know, they're trying to get out of here. They're trying to get in and out. Whatever. We'll see what happens. I have a feeling a few people are going to be driving up on these things, you know?
Yeah, it's like you said, learning curve. It's going to take a little time, I think, for people to get used to them. And yeah. It may create more problems than it solves for a little bit.
Good.
Yeah. Bill, we had a batch of stories this week, which I thought was really interesting, about changes in the village. Right. A lot of businesses changing. And I mean, I think you get that every off season, you have a little bit of turnover, but the number of changes in Southampton Village are really significant. And it sort of starts with that corner property on Hill Street and Windmill Lane that has always been a fascinating thing to me. That building has essentially sat more or less empty for just years and years and years and years. And now it looks like something's coming in there.
It's going to be a provisions market. And I have to say, I'm not super familiar with provisions, but that's the plan. And the scaffolding has been up there for days or longer as they're redoing the building. There's some other changes. One exciting change that really blew up on our social media when we you know put the story out is Skip Norsick. Who you know from Norsic, I forget the name of the company, but the trash haulers, he came in and he bought the old Le Chef building, and it looks like that's going to be a new spot for the Plaza Cafe and
Julia.
Julia, thank you for pronouncing that. And people are real excited about that. And Doug has been saying, you know, we interviewed him, you know, late last year, and you know, it's that he's been looking for a new spot. You know, he's kind of hidden back where the old radio station used to be. Brian, and kind of hidden in there. Does a great business, but this will be a little more. It'll be more out front and more public facing. The fun part of that was that Skip Norsick and Doug are first cousins, so they're kind of working together on this new venture, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah, and Doug's Plaza Cafe was in danger of losing that spot anyway. I think that building, there are plans for that building, so he was going to need to find a place anyway, right?
Yeah,
I think so. As the theater talked about different proposals,
and that as you say, with the provisions, and then Le Chef, and then the construction on Hill Street, and then the movie theater. There, constant renovation. I mean, this thing is moving along. It's right next door to the radio station. the village is going to be a different place.
And our story this week said something that I wasn't aware of, which is now the talk is that theater may be trying to add an IMAX screen, which would really be kind of an interesting addition for Southampton Village if they were able to pull that off. And also, we should mention, Bill, up at the other end of the village, there's also some changes, and we're going to be losing a long-term Chinese takeout restaurant that's been up there for years and years and years. I think 30 years.
It's right? China Garden next to Cinderella, and a place that I've bought many lunches from over the years. It's been there for 30 years, and it is a reasonable alternative for a lot of working people in the village. Their lease has not been renewed. It's not clear if Cinderella is going to be expanding into that or not, and then the building next to that, Joe, is going to be a Buddhaberry, the popular Sag Harbor establishment that has been looking for a foothold in Southampton Village too. So yeah, it's going to be an exciting business summer, I think, in the village. A lot of different changes.
Exciting is a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
change can be good, Brian.
No, it could be, but I don't know. It's when it leans towards, like you said, it was a good. The Chinese place was a good place for working class folks to get a lunch. It's going to be. Seems like fewer and fewer places like that, and I'm thinking now, Caneo's has got to find a new place there up in Sag Harbor.
We haven't talked about that. That is really a significant.
That is a yes
development. Yeah, Caneo's is arguably. An elemental part of the cultural landscape in Sag Harbor.
No question, right? All those readings that you took part in so many times, Joe, and the Steinbeck stuff, and just a fixture. Bookstores are a big part of, it's like the old general store. People just congregate and hang around.
And I love how Caneo sort of runs counter to the standard line, the standard story about bookstores, which is that they're all in trouble. Well, they're going to, they've lost their lease, but they are hoping to relocate somewhere. Yes. And they are alive and well. And it's really important, I think, for Sag Harbor to have Caneo's stay alive. I think it's more than just a local business. I think it's a real institution. No question. Right. Yeah, absolutely. So we only have a little bit of time left. I want to talk very briefly, Joe, about your story this week about the Shinnecock Dispensary, the Shinnecock Cannabis Dispensary. You had a story this week. They've sort of run afoul with some of their creditors, right?
Yeah, so the Little Beach Harvest opened in November, cannabis dispensary. Obviously a lot of sort of fanfare, I guess, with, the new marijuana laws in New York and when that opened. And but what we've heard is some of the contractors for that have not gotten their full payments yet and are kind of, feeling like, the time is up for what they're owed. And from what we've heard, the total is about $1.6 million, and So so the way it works is, you have a general contractor on a project, and then you have subcontractors underneath them who do various elements of the project, from electrical work to plumbing or whatever it may be. And so all these subcontractors have kind of gotten together and are trying to collectively see if they can put maybe some pressure on them to get payments, and they're considering litigation. As far as I know, as of now, they haven't actually filed any lawsuit. Their attorney said they're looking at their legal options at last we heard. What seems part of the issue is original investor on the project ran into some issues and had to pull out, and passed on the investment to a different company. And so it's not entirely clear how much that led to what's going on here. From what the Shinnecock said, they sort of described this as kind of a typical dispute that may happen between a contractor and didn't really get into many specifics on that to sort of elaborate. So, so that's kind of the gist of it right now. And, we'll see, if it ends up in court with a lawsuit filed down the road. And, it's the sovereign territory. So it's, changes things a little bit in terms of what kind of recourse, they may have in terms of, like a typical foreclosure or something like that doesn't necessarily apply on the sovereign territory.
Got it. Brian, we have 2 minutes left, and we wanted to talk about the Whodunit Festival that's coming up, which is a very cool thing. And it's next week. Tell us about it. You guys have a role, right?
Yeah, we do. We do. simply, folks can go to Hampton's Whodunit, and Dunn is spelled D-U-N. HamptonsWhodunit.org. It starts this Thursday, the 11th, runs through Sunday, the 14th, in East Hampton Village. And it's all about true crime and fiction mysteries. And if you go to the website, you'll see a great schedule. There'll be, like a seminar on Agatha Christie. There'll be some of the newest or the most recent authors that do very well in this genre of true crime and suspense. They've got like forensic people going to be there, and escape rooms. And it sounds like a lot of fun. And we're going to be broadcasting live on Friday the 12th from 1 to 2 in the afternoon. And contrary to your colleague's comment, this will not be the first time I've ever been in a library. We'll be broadcasting live from 1 to 2 Friday afternoon the 12th, myself and some folks from the radio station, Diane Michelli, our general manager. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So it's HamptonsWhodunit.org this Thursday, 11th through the 14th, for suspense and true crime folks. And if you ever have the pleasure to be on this show, a good analogy would be Joe Shaw is the good cop, Bill Sutton is the bad cop. They try to get you to talk.
We try and work it. Sometimes we work it the other way.
I think for the most part, Sutton is the bad cop.
He is.
I kind of enjoy that.
Yeah, he does. Carries himself more like bad cop, no question. I'm not very intimidating.
Exactly right, but you're much more kinder. Yes,
that's one word for it.
Yeah. I think Bill just plays devil's advocate all the time. That's what
he does.
He does. Yeah,
he's very contrarian, and that's one of the things.
I'm not.
There you go. And that's it for our latest edition of Behind the Headlines. Thank you to our panelists, Brian Cosgrove of WLIW, Denise Civiletti of Riverhead Local, and Joe Workmeister of Newsday. And thank you also to my co-host, Bill Sutton. I'm Joe Shaw. We'll be back next week with another edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks, guys.